Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming down the home stretch with Delton Wally Walling. If you missed the first part of his story last time, you can pull up that podcast at hometownheroesradio.com. When we left off before the break, he talked about the casualties his ship evacuated from Iwo Jima, his chief's quarters turned into a makeshift operating room, and that air of death and destruction that became a constant companion.
Really, after a while, never even thought about it. It's just another day.
Just got so used to the death around
you? That's it. See, I was evacuated by air from Guadalcanal, or from Tulagi. I had a serious stomach ailment come up, and so they put me in a hospital in Tulagi. That's when they're still fighting over there on Guadalcanal. Oh. So they put me over there in the hospital, and Tulagi had just been taken, and they had a small hospital there. I was in the hospital room in the afternoon, and there was 5 or 6 Marines that was in there with me. And their captain that afternoon came over with a 5th of 3 Feathers whiskey. And we decided to remove the whiskey. 20 minutes after we got loaded, emergency comes in. Grab your sea bags. We're evacuating you from Tulagi. It's a storm, rough storm, lightning everywhere. Put us in that old C-35. Away we go. Sick. Well, that little flight from Tulagi to Espiritu Santo, that plane didn't smell the same when they got there.
I believe it.
I come out of the hospital a few days later. I'm over there in the receiving station. So they put me in charge of the brig. I'm waiting for a ship to come in to get back up to Hollandia, New Guinea. While I'm there, a few days later, 2 LSTs come in from the States. And they couldn't navigate out of a 50-gallon drum. And they were 2 weeks over. Just getting in there to Espiritu. So they come over and ask me, they had to go up to Manus Island on the Bismarck Sea. And I just left that area. And they asked me if I would navigate them up there. I didn't know they was loaded with 100 tons of ammunition. I said, oh yeah, could that get me up there, you know, get me closer home. So I volunteered. Well, I can tell you that trip, you sat on thin ice all the way. Because all that area up there below New Britain Island is all held by and fighting Japanese. There's ships in there, there's boats in there. And then I get the message on there to be sure to check out every vessel you see, because it might be Japanese.
And you realize that you're on a floating bomb, because if anything it all hits you guys, you're up in smoke.
So everything went fine until I came through the straits there at Cape Gloucester again. 10 o'clock at night. Big, beautiful moon. And all at once I pick up a bogey, and he don't answer me back. Well, is he Japanese? Is he what? What is he? He's coming towards me. I'm going to the starboard just as fast as that'll go, only about 7 knots, so I'm not going to get away from him anyway. But I'm trying to evade him. And over the horizon it comes, and it's a 4-stacker cruiser, and I don't recognize him. And so I jump up on the bow of that LSD, and they got the big 30-inch light. I can blast you for a mile, you know. Mm-hmm. And I just flashed it. Who are you? I'm American. You got to tell them, because they're broadsiding me. They're getting ready to let it go. The reason they're going to let it go is because on top of that LSD, we got 2 tank landing craft on there that changes the silhouette of that LSD. See, and they don't have that change. All they're seeing a strange ship, and there's lots of Japanese. So they're going to broadside me and let me have it. I told them who I was, and they come back and said, SS Canberra out of Sydney, and we're all shot up. Keep on moving off to starboard because the San Francisco is under a tow behind us, and they may give it to you. Well, listen, I'm not going to get near San Francisco. Sitting right in the entrance is, I pull into Hollandia. Sitting right in the entrance is a ammunition ship. They keep the ammunition ships out of the harbors if they got ships on it. And as I'm coming, here comes my ship that I want to get on, and it's going over to Hollandia.
Uh-huh.
That's where it's headed for that night. So I talked to them, and they said, if you can get over there, we can pick you up tomorrow. So I went on in, went by the ammunition ship, went down, tied up about 2 miles down, tied up to shore, and that ammunition ship blew up. Prettiest sight you'll ever see is an ammunition ship blowing up. Just went by it 15 minutes ago.
Yeah, timing is everything.
And so then that night I got a small landing craft and went across to Landia and got back with my ship.
Getting back to your ship wasn't so easy.
It was, oh no.
You almost got blown up by one of your own ships and, that wanted to take you out, and then...
You see, I don't know. Just how lucky can you get?
Is that it? Do you think it's luck? Or do you think somebody had planned for you?
It just, well, somebody looked out for me, I guess.
And still is, apparently.
Now, you want to know what I did to come out of the service? I'll just give you a short one.
All right.
February 27th. After I come out of the service... and 80% disabled, sent home with my pension of $110. They said, you can't work, be around people for about a year, and then you'll be all right.
And this is from what we know now is PTSD, and then
that's
it's
right.
You're shell-shocked, you're battle-fatigued,
yeah.
And it's your fault, pretty much, is what they're telling you.
That's right. This is what they tell you. You joined to fight a war. You did it on your own. I didn't get drafted or nothing.
Right.
So... what are you crying about?
Mm-hmm.
What happened to you is tough.
You cut off your finger to get in the Navy.
Tough.
Yeah.
See, I was home a year, but I got a wife and a little child. I've got to go to work. So I go to work, and immediately they start taking my pension away from me. Within a year, they got down to $10. And, of course, you read the story that I told them.
Yeah. You told them to keep their $10.
Yeah, and what they could do with it.
Put it where the sun doesn't shine. Yeah.
Then I left Michigan. When my wheels froze down to the cement back there, I said, I don't want it here. Mm-hmm. So I came to California, not knowing you don't come to California in the wintertime. There's no jobs.
Mm.
And there was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I arrived in California with $6 in my pocket. I had to stand in those stores down there with the rest of the bums down there in Skid Row for a few days. When I arrived in Stockton, I made out an application any place that I could get it. A month later, February 27, 1947, Fiberbird calls me. Said, well, we don't have a real good job for you, but we need a sweeper. I said, I'll be there. So I went over there and started on the last day of February 47 as a sweeper. In 1952, I went to Baltimore. This paper company is the biggest on the West Coast. 27 plants. They got a lot of people. I went to Baltimore and took over their plant as a superintendent. September of 1952. You see how lucky in my life it's been. Go back in the Navy. What happened when I first went in? How long it took me to become one of the youngest chiefs in the United States Navy. Short period of time. And then I come out in civilian life and devastated because I don't know nothing. In that short 5 years, I went to a superintendent. And I was with them 29 years. And I handled every job that they ever gave me. When I was 55... I retired from Fiberboard. I went back to sea, and I had two commercial salmon boats on the West Coast. So I'm known from Fort Bragg to Alaska, and I just retired that. I was 89 when I made my last trip to the South Pacific on a big tuna boat. I was down there 3 months. And when I come back into Newport, Oregon, and I was 89, bad night when I come in, and I looked in the mirror and I said, you old son of a gun, what are you doing? You don't belong here. And so I quit.
Well, one thing that comes to mind is you talk about sailing even into your late 80s. Had to deal with a lot of weather over the years, but I'm sure nothing was quite like what's become known as Halsey's Typhoon.
Oh.
And you were in that.
Boy, our ship was cracked right through the middle, right at the superstructure when it's over. We wouldn't have stayed up much longer.
Just from the force of these waves and wind.
Yeah.
That must have been a pretty rocky ride.
Oh.
If you're on that ship. What did it feel like?
You cannot stand up.
Uh-huh.
You cannot walk on the deck. Uh-huh. You got to sit down. There's no way.
Are you thinking you're going to go under?
Oh, that's all you can think about.
Yeah.
You got your life jacket on, but what good is it?
And you saw some of those capsized destroyers.
Yeah. Well, I saw the hull.
How close were you?
200 yards.
So you see this whole destroyer.
Hull went over and then picked up the water in the stack And then the next time it just went over and the screws kept turning.
So you're looking at an upside down ship with the screws, the propeller out of the water, yep, turning in there. What are you doing when that is going on?
Nothing. The people on the bridge is just trying to hold that ship into the waves. Just barely headway, just enough, because you don't want to plow into it because your more force is coming up.
And what about when the war ended? Here you were there the day it began. You saw it all firsthand. To find out that Japan was surrendering, what did that mean to you?
Well, now, you see, I've been asked many times in the speeches, when the bomb was dropped, do you really think it was necessary? What did it accomplish? I let them decide. That bomb that we dropped in there, all together, say 300,000 to 400,000, it killed.
Both on initial impact and radiation later. Yeah.
But had we made the landing, they estimated it would cost 2 million lives at Japan. They were way short. I made a trip with a woman that was on Japan at that time. She had went to visit and got locked there.
Uh-huh.
And every man, woman, and child was armed with a bamboo stick. So now, if we made a landing, we've got to kill everybody ahead of us.
And they would have fought to the death.
And they would have fought to the death.
They were fighting for the divine emperor. Yeah.
So we're talking about 20 million.
Well, and those estimates said at least 1 million Americans would die.
That's right.
In the invasion.
That's right. So I leave it up to them.
The math tells the story, huh?
The math, yeah. I'm so thankful to all the people in my life that I've been acquainted with. I'm very thankful to have known them all.
I'm looking at some pictures here on your wall, and just a couple of things come to mind. One picture is Washington, D.C., and you're both at the Marine Corps Memorial with that giant rendering of the flag that you saw when it happened.
Yep.
The first time and that second time that's depicted there. The other picture I see over there is you skydiving.
Yeah.
When did you start doing that?
When Bush made his jump. And
former President George H.W. Bush.
When he made his jump. It was put on television and all this stuff. And I thought, holy mackerel, I'm a little older than he is. Why don't I do it? So I went down and I did it.
And since then you do it every year on your birthday?
Yeah.
If you're
every
up to it?
Every year on my birthday.
So May 6th of 2017, are we going to see a 96-year-old jumping out of a plane?
You will if I can walk over there to it.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story and keeping the memory of your fellow veterans alive. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you think is really important for people to know?
Well, I don't think so. They've got a pretty good cross picture of my life and how I think.
What are you proud of? What are you most proud of?
I'm the most proud of helping anybody that's in trouble.
Well, I'm just thinking about all this, Wally. You're there on December 7th. You saw what you saw. So many things throughout the war that you witnessed, things that you had to survive. In your life since, as you said, you've been going, 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 going. You skydived on your birthday. You've caught some of the biggest fish in the world. All these things that you've talked about. Is there anything that you haven't done yet that you still want to do?
Maybe there is, but I've run out of time. This cancer of the bone, you're limited to the time that's left.
And you don't know how much that is.
Then they won't even talk to you about it. You're going to go. No, you can't stop it.
It's not being treated.
No, you can't treat it. All you can do is take the pain medicine. And I don't take that because the minute you start taking this high-powered stuff, you're going to lose more of what little brains I got left.
And you need your brains because you still have a story to tell.
That's right.
And people to tell it to.
I won't turn anybody down.
I'm thinking about how much time you spend trying to make sure the rest of us remember Pearl Harbor and remember the lives lost that day. What about you? How do you want to be remembered?
Just what I'm saying. I want to be remembered. The man that didn't let the rest of the world forget the story of Pearl Harbor or the Pacific. I went to the last. And I'll do it to the last.
I believe you. Thanks, Wally.
And I'm so grateful to have met so many wonderful people that's taken a part of my life and made me what I am. I thank them all. I'll go out fighting. I started out in life fighting. I'll go out the same way.
Truly one of a kind, Wally Walling. You might enjoy the photos and videos of Wally at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll hear from another Pearl Harbor survivor next time. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more that freedom is not free.